Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, mortgage lenders ramp up how much people can borrow, a helping hand, or a recipe for disaster. Meanwhile, the Bank of England is tipped to slash rates twice in 2 months as tax hikes and US tariffs batter the economy. Our pensions agony uncle, Sir Steve Webb, loves his solar panels. Should you get some? What kind of investor are you and how to work it out? And finally, the best cars of all time. But do you agree with the winner? Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, two more major lenders have relaxed their mortgage rules, meaning home buyers can now potentially borrow tens of thousands of pounds more. So both HSBC and First Direct say the changes to the stress rates used in their mortgage affordability calculations will benefit those either buying or remortgaging. Now, it follows similar moves from Lloyds Banking Group and Santander. Meanwhile, April Mortgages, who they, you might ask, is offering buyers the opportunity to borrow up to 7 times annual salary as opposed to the usual 4.5 times. So, as I asked earlier, a much needed helping hand to get on the property ladder particularly, or a disaster waiting to happen. Lee, Simon, welcome. Lee, what is going on out there at the moment?
So banks have become a little bit more flexible, a little bit more generous in what the risk they're willing to take on people and how much annual salary that they're willing to lend on. So what happened in the aftermath of the financial crisis is that stress testing became a way bigger thing. It became a regulatory requirement. What it means is your ability, if you are taking out a mortgage, to pay off said mortgage if rates went higher, which is what happened in the aftermath of that mini budget, which we've talked about a billion times on this podcast. But it was to stop people having real shocks and not being able to afford their mortgage, which is what happened in the financial crisis. And the financial crisis, while it does feel a very long time ago now, wasn't actually that long ago. A lot of that was boiled also down to interest-only mortgages, which were very mainstream in the financial crisis. And a lot of people got burnt. A lot of people were in negative equity. A lot of people struggled to repay their mortgage and struggled to keep on top of it. So the stress testing really was to prevent some of that. And I think actually it's kind of done its job. You know, repossessions are probably far less common than what they were, especially in that financial crisis, you know, shock aftermath of the years after that. What's happening now is that these major lenders, big lenders, are moving the goalposts somewhat and changing the stress test rates, which means in theory that people looking to take out a mortgage can borrow more than what was previously on offer. So the rule of thumb really is 4.5 times your annual salary. And if you're buying as a couple, that's combined. And I think a lot of people have that ingrained in their mind, rough ballpark, that's what you can borrow on top of the deposit. We had moves. Last month, Santander relaxed its mortgage affordability rules, a huge lender, which it said could allow customers to borrow up to 35% more. Lloyds, a couple of weeks ago, did the same thing and said that people will be able to borrow up to 13% more on a mortgage. And then this week we've had HSBC and First Direct. First Direct is part of HSBC, saying that it's doing the same thing. And it could allow 20,000 more customers to get a home loan. And it could mean a bump of up to £39,000. So it's shifting the goalposts a little bit, being a little bit more flexible and a little bit more generous in the risk that they're willing to take. Whether it goes back to what you said at the beginning, is this a bad thing? It's hard to say, really, isn't it? I mean, if you're someone that's looking to get onto the housing ladder or make a move and you're just not quite there, it makes sense to be able to borrow just a little bit more. And then it's how much is too much extra. But it's showing that there's a loosening slightly of these affordability rules.
How much Is too much extra, Simon? There's a question. Will you stick your neck out and say, is this a helping hand or is this a disaster waiting to happen? What are your thoughts?
Let me take you back in time. Do 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 do. I know you were waiting for me to do that, weren't you? To a young girl, a young Simon Lambert, in the early days of his career at This Is Money, pre-financial crisis and credit crunch, as the housing market was going gangbusters, everything was going up. Property just couldn't stop going up. And there was a bank that announced that it was going to lend 5, 6 times salary. And there was a number of them. Then they followed suit. And what happens when this happens is you tend to get maybe one do it, and then they kind of either row back, or if it catches on, you get more doing it. And it was the first time I ever did a TV segment. And I went and did something with ITV News. I was talking to some first-time buyers. I remember the journalist at the Times opening line, up, up. Up go the house prices. And basically, it was about lending people more money and banks coming up with ways to lend people more money. So, understandably, there are concerns whenever you read anything about banks coming up with ways to lend people more money, because we remember how that one ended. And in fact, we remember how this ends every time banks come up with ways to lend people more money. And what's interesting in this cycle is that we haven't seen one specific method used to do this. We've seen a number of them. So, for example, much longer mortgage terms, going from a standard mortgage term of 25 to 30 to 35 to 40 years is one way of doing it. Tweaking the stress tests is another. And the Bank of England and the financial regulators in charge of this stuff have indicated that they're okay with this kind of thing, as long as people are, sticking to the spirit of it, and that perhaps these have been a bit too restrictive. And actually, for a long time, people thought these were way too restrictive because people were borrowing at 1.5% and then being stress tested at 5.5%, 6.5%. As Lee pointed out, though, what did happen was what people did not expect to happen. Because there was this whole like mortgage rates are not going back to 6.5%. They're just not going back to 6.5% line that was going around. And most people believed it. I was shocked at how high mortgage rates went up. But lo and behold, they did spike after inflation suddenly returned with a vengeance post-COVID. And maybe those stress tests did actually do a load of people a favor and mean that they were able to, keep their mortgages, not fall into financial difficulty. The other thing that obviously enabled people to borrow a lot more money and feeds into why this is different to pre-financial crisis was interest-only mortgages. The thing that lenders came up with as a ruse in the early 2000s to allow borrowers to keep pace with the relentless rise of house prices was to bin off the idea of making sure that they could repay their mortgage. Previously, people were only able to take interest-only mortgages if they proved they had a way of repaying it. That changed, and through the 2000s, through to the financial crisis, they weren't even asked to prove it. They didn't have to be the old-fashioned endowment plan, a savings plan, an investment plan, anything. It was just like, fine, you can have the interest-only mortgage. And it enabled people to borrow huge amounts more. Something I've talked about like lots of times in the past, but I remember when we got our first mortgage to buy our flat, being asked at the time by the broker, are you sure you wouldn't like to get an interest-only mortgage? Because you could borrow quite a lot more and you might be able to buy a more expensive property. And we were like, no, it's fine, actually. We're all right. And you know what? We avoided getting massively caught out by the financial crisis. But actually, because everybody got bailed out by low rates and everything, probably would have done us a favor. Probably would have ended up quids in eventually. But the problem is that you often don't shift back to a position where you're ever going to repay that mortgage. And I read an interesting statistic the other day, and I'll credit the person to who this came from. It actually came from George Nixon, formerly of This Is Money. 61,000 mortgages were switched from repayment to interest only in 2023, compared to 2,000 in 2022.
Wow. Wow.
That I mean, that's a really, really big difference. That's 30 times more, and that's in 2023. So I would imagine that unless something very weird happened, at that point, and that was when mortgage rates were spiking, but I would imagine that that trend may have continued, and I'd be interested to see what the numbers are for 2024. And my concern would be that potentially what's going on here is lenders are looking at the scenario going, okay, borrowers have got fairly comfortable with higher mortgage rates. Actually, we haven't had the catastrophe that some were expecting. Maybe we can afford to lend them a bit more money. Maybe it's fine. Maybe we'd be okay. And maybe if they're wealthy, they've got higher incomes and everything, we could lend them a bit of money on interest only, or do an interest only mortgage, helps them get a home. But the problem is you're leaving yourself very little margin for error if things go wrong. The magnifying effect of rates suddenly going up on an interest only mortgage is much greater because the interest, it's just the interest that you're paying. So, if interest rates double, your payments double. Whereas that doesn't happen with a repayment mortgage. And my concern would be that I think sometimes we rely a little bit too much on the, oh, well, they're higher earners and they've got plenty of money. And actually, as we've talked about many times on the podcast in the past, those higher earners are being really squeezed quite tightly at the moment on everything from tax to childcare costs to, the cost of affording that bigger home, etc. And I do worry that this might all blow up in our faces.
Yep. So Lee, Simon's outlined some of the risks there. I was reading about the April mortgages story, and this is about they're offering buyers the opportunity to borrow up to 7 times annual salary, as we said, as opposed to 4.5 times. Now, if you're looking to get another mortgage, you have to make sure that if you are moving to another lender, that they will also offer that. But who are April mortgages?
So April Mortgages launched last year. They're backed by a big Dutch company, a residential mortgage company in Holland. And their USP for the mortgage market is long-term fixes. Some of them are saying that, which are quite commonplace in other countries across the world. And the USP really is 10-year fixes, 15-year fixes, which is kind of quite unusual for the mortgage market, where we're used to having 2-year fixes, 5-year fixes, and being on an SVR, standard variable rate. So they're trying to shake up the mortgage industry a little bit by offering, I guess you could call it, long-term stability, because you're getting that rate over that course of time. And having just come off the back of the mortgage rate spike, some people might be interested in this. Before I wade into the full ins and outs of this, headline grabbing 7 times income, it sounds really interesting on paper in terms of it's something quite different. But do you remember a couple of years ago when we had Skipton launching the 99% mortgage? There was loads of fanfare around that. In the end, really, if I'm being quite frank, it was just a bit of a PR exercise ever skipped, and there wasn't, when the stats came out of how many people actually opened that mortgage, it was very few. And it's going to be the same for this. It's going to take a really unique set of circumstances for someone to go and open an April mortgage, I would suggest. So quickly with this mortgage, they are offering it with this 7 times multiple. We should point some things out here. There's no early repayment charges for switching to another lender, because 10 to 15 years is quite a long time. But to switch to another lender, you will need to be able to obviously pass that lender's affordability rules, which might be very different to this. And then you could find yourself finding it difficult to move. Overpayments are allowed at any time without a penalty. And April says that mortgage rates automatically reduce as borrowers pay down their loan and move into lower loan to value bands. Now, that's providing that your house is going up in value. There's lots of things that could potentially change in that scenario. Now, Ed Magnus, our mortgage reporter, has gone and sort of crunched some figures on this. I should also point out here that the rates that are on offer from April are higher than what you're going to get elsewhere, for the very reason that it's offering that kind of long-term fix, and they're not best buys. We've seen some moves actually this week in which we're seeing mortgage rates dip under 4% for those with the very biggest deposits. So essentially, on an 80% LTV, for example, it's 5.65% on 10 years, 5.75% over 15 years. So what Ed's done quite cleverly in this piece, if you're listening, Ed, well done. He's looked at some scenarios. So for a couple earning £30,000 a year each, he's worked out that it'd be taking home £2,093 every month after income tax and national insurance is deducted. That's a combined £4,186 after tax. And that's before any pension contributions, childcare costs, student loan repayments, or any other commitments. So April says that a household owning a combined £60,000 gross income could potentially borrow up to £420,000 of them. £420,000 mortgage fixed at 5.55% on a 36-year term. I should also point out here that they don't offer 25-year term, 30-year terms. It starts on a 36-year term basis. The goalposts on that have shifted a lot. I would say a decade ago, a 25-year term was probably the norm, and it was nudging towards 30 then. There's quite a lot of basically borrowers getting onto the property market by stretching over now for 35 to 40 years. There's been a big shift in that. I don't know what the latest stats are, but I know it was growing at a massive rate in order to bring down monthly mortgage repayments. Anyway, a 420,000 pound mortgage fixed 5.55% on a 36-year term would cost £2,248 per month. After paying the mortgage each month, that would leave the couple with a combined £1,938 a month between them to pay for everything else. We're talking here food, travel, utilities, leisure, property repairs, bills, council tax, lots and lots of things that you've got to consider in that. And so, as Ed concludes here, for most people, that would make for a very tight budget. So, in conclusion, Georgie, I thought I'm doing an essay here. It sounds interesting on paper. It's going to be for very few people, I would suggest, that would probably opt for this. And a broker potentially might have April mortgages on their radar, but they might potentially not. And it would take a lot of thinking space and sort of think, really kicking the tires on this and thinking, is this something that's in order to get onto the property ladder by bending the rules slightly with a 7x annual income multiple rather than a 4.5x, whether it's ultimately worth it.
All right, then, just a quick one, Lee. Do you think you'd expect more of these sort of loosenings, as it were, to come from lenders?
I'd expect so, Georgie. If big lenders like HSBC, Lloyds, and Santander, but basically three of, the biggest lenders in the country are doing this, I'd find it very difficult to not think that a Barclays, a Nationwide, and NatWest, won't follow suit. But they're their own entities. They've got their own risk appetite. But I'm sure there's discussions underway in those various mortgage departments, seeing what, as Simon says, quite often, one of these big banks does something like this, they will end up doing it.
Meanwhile, something that will help borrowers, financial markets are pricing in a just a tiny little slim 100% chance of a Bank of England interest rate cut apparently next month. Seem pretty convinced about that. And another expected straight away afterwards. So the Governor Andrew Bailey spoke at an event in Washington this week. He was saying that he takes the threat posed to growth by trade turmoil very seriously. It comes, the latest evidence emerged that Labour's tax hikes and US tariffs are battering the economy. So, mirroring the expected Bank of England cuts, Nationwide reduced rates by up to 0.25 percentage points on a range of mortgage products this week. So, its lowest mortgage rate for a 2 5-year fixed products is 3.89%. Simon, 100%, really? Why so convinced?
Nothing's ever 100%. Nothing's ever 100%. But we can just make up percentage numbers nowadays. I think if we'd learned anything from the last 3 weeks,
Exactly.
it's like we can just make up percentage numbers. Come up with your own formula, make up your own numbers. This just shows how interest rate expectations change substantially and why you shouldn't put too much heed in thinking that just because the markets are forecast something's going to happen, it's going to happen, or analysts have forecast something's going to happen, it's going to happen. Because it's not that long ago that interest rate cuts were off the table due to the arrival of Donald Trump as president. Now, due to the arrival of Donald Trump as president, interest rates are going to be cut by more. Who knows? I think the Bank of England are genuinely concerned by what is going on here. And one of the reasons is that underneath all the bluster from Trump on tariffs and all of the many words written about it by all of the people who have suddenly become global trade experts, this is the most substantial trade barrier raising tariff war seen in decades, if not longer. I read a very interesting article on this by someone who had actually done the research to show some expertise in trade wars and everything. So I'm not going to try and paraphrase it too much, but you're going back to the kind of late 19th century kind of thing. This is, a serious potential impediment to global growth for the reasons we talked about in last week's podcast. If you want to go into more depth about that, go and listen back when we talked about it. But basically, what it means is there's going to be less people doing business with other people, more protectionism, people rowing back on it. That's what's behind the downgrading of growth prospects. And even if we do relatively well out of this, which, potentially the UK will do, any global slowdown is likely to impact us and knock growth here. And it knocks business confidence. And that, again, knocks domestic growth. And so the Bank of England is looking at the situation and saying things have changed compared to where we were. And we think we might need to change our view. But, it depends on the votes of those rate setters on the Monetary Policy Committee. Are you going to get enough of them voting for a cut to outweigh those who are voting for a hold? I think probably the answer could be yes, but not 100%.
Lee, Simon there talks about how we, could have got away with the worst of it. Although, if you listen to the IMF, they painted a rather grim picture for the UK. The former Bank of England official, Andrew Sentence, said public finances were out of control. The OBR has come in for some criticism about the way it crunches all its numbers. I mean, it's not painting a very pretty picture, is it?
It didn't paint a pretty picture for basically any major economy, no, did it, Georgie? I mean, it came out and said that the US growth forecast was the hardest hit by the Trump tariffs and all that chaos that's gone on in the rest of the month. The IMF downgrading these forecasts, it's kind of a bit arbitrary, isn't it? Because how much do you read into it? How much do you believe in these growth forecasts? Who knows what Donald Trump might do next week, let alone what might happen over the rest of the course of the year? It's kind of a difficult one to really comment on because I could be saying this now. We're talking about tariffs, for example, the whole China versus USA thing. I mean, what's the tariff at now? Do you even know? Does anyone know? It's just like
Yeah,
it's gone absolutely.
124%.
I mean, that's what I mean. But the growth forecast has gone down for the US to 1.8%, which was 2.7% in January. UK growth forecast has been cut and is now forecast to be at 1.1%. But also in this IMF report, and I think that quite interestingly, from this conversation that we've been having throughout this year, inflation in the UK is forecast to be the highest in the world's advanced economies at 3.1%, largely due to higher bills, including for energy and water. I mean, water bills have gone through the absolute roof. And energy bills, electricity bills, gas, it looks like they're going to be ticking higher over the course of this year. So there's loads of things at play, and Donald Trump is just sort of like this big grenade that anything could happen. So these IMF figures, USA, the US was at 2.7% at the start of the year. It's now at 1.8%. Canada 2% is now at 1.4%. Japan was at 1.1%. It's now 0.6%. UK 1.6 to 1.1. Germany 0.3 to 0%. Italy 0.7 to 0.4, and
Oh
France
dear.
0.8 to 0.6. That is not a pretty picture in the space of, a handful of months, is it?
I mean, the only thing I would say about the incredibly gloomy IMF outlook is that I was quite cheered by it because, like all major forecasters that carry extreme heft, the IMF has a habit of being consistently really quite wrong. So, actually, when it said things were really bad, and ladled on the doom and gloom for the UK, my initial reaction was, oh, great, things are actually going to pick up then. I think we might be past the worst. I mean, that might be just be me being contrary, but it's like that thing where something that you know about that's a bit more niche than the general population know about suddenly becomes mainstream and ends up on the front cover of newspapers and magazines, and you know at that point it's done. Things are on the up. Rest of the year is going to
Well,
be banging.
let's hope so. But Look, it's not just house price figures that I famously dislike. It's any sort of prediction. I appreciate that we need some sort of guidance, perhaps, as to what's going on. But it's so often wrong. It's so often coming to criticism. The latest is the OBR. But when you have real world actions taken on those predictions, and by which you spoke about it, Simon, you wrote about it, was these weird figures that Rachel Reeves suddenly in the spring statement, lo and behold, things have shifted, but she's managed to fandangle a few things, magic some numbers up, and whoa, her headroom has returned. Now, with all of these predictions, look, I'll be honest, it's not looking good. It's not looking good that we get to the budget and that, headroom that's been magicked back will still be there. So are we going to get some more fiscal shenanigans, chicanery, whatever you want to call it, from the Chancellor, which will come through, yes, spending cuts and tax rises?
Yeah, and I would be concerned about that, actually. My great concern is, as you talked about, as I wrote about, as we talked about on the podcast, the fact that we are repeatedly making the same mistake of making bad decisions or decisions that are not right for the future of what we need to do in this country and are not tackling the problems that are getting worse with our finances and our financial situation, owing to the fact that we're depending, trying to fit ourselves into boxes defined by forecasts that are guaranteed to be wrong. And the spring statement, I think, is a case in point. If I was writing economics textbooks, which I'm not going to write any economics textbooks, but if I were to write an economics textbook, okay, I would highlight the spring statement as a classic example of making fiscal statements based on forecasts that are guaranteed to be wrong. Because not only were you doing it off the back of, it was a change from the budget, which was not that much longer before it, where it was based on forecasts that then turned out to be wrong. So we had to change it in the spring statement. But we then knew that something was going to happen in, what was it, a week after, right? Donald Trump has said he was having Liberation Day. Chances were Liberation Day was not going to just be a bit, more of the same. We'll just keep sailing on the same course. Something was going to happen, good or bad. More chance bad than good. We knew it was going to happen. Yet still, we had this event, we had these forecasts, we made some decisions, made some spending cuts, we made some decisions for the future of this country based on forecasts that were certainly going to be wrong, because not only are forecasts normally wrong, but we were going to have tariff day a week later. Lo and behold, tariff day arrives, everything goes out the window. I would also, in my economics textbook, put down the tariff stuff as an example of how tit for tat trade wars work.
That's it for part one.
I am joined now by Alex Webb-Bowen of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Alex, a quick question from a listener. I've got some money in a cash ISA that I'd like to invest. Should I take the money out and pay it into a stocks and shares ISA, or should I transfer it?
Hi, Simon. So the short answer is you should transfer it. If you withdraw the full sum and then repay it fresh into a stocks and shares ISA, you'll be limited by the ISA allowance, so the £20,000 a year. But more significantly, you will lose the tax benefits that you had previously associated with the money. So whereas before, in previous years, as you use your allowance, you accumulate the sum that is tax wrapped, you would essentially be moving it from a sheltered environment into an unsheltered environment. So the previous years of your contributions will no longer count. So yeah, transfer it directly and the total sum remains tax wrapped.
Alex, thank you very much.
Thanks, Simon.
Welcome back. Now, we are used to the sage words and advice of Sir Steve Webb when it comes to our retirement savings, but this week, our pensions agony uncle has been extolling the virtue of something else entirely. His solar panels. At a time when bills are soaring, Sir Steve says he's even made a profit, Leibois, on his electricity bill. So why is Sir Steve so in love with his solar panels?
I really like this, Georgie. It's a kind of real different turn of pace, isn't it? I think Steve Webb solar panels. I
Right?
just
Didn't see that coming.
I didn't see it coming. I did not see it coming. Listen, I think anyone that gets solar panels, usually on the whole, I hear kind of positive stories about. I think quite often it's the initial kind of shock and the initial kind of having to get it sorted, and the thought of putting something on your roof and the scaffolding and the initial outlay, that just puts a lot of people off. They just think, oh, I can't be bothered with that. And then a lot of people will think, well, it will take 10, 15 years for them to pay back the investment. Am I going to be in this house for 10, 15 years? If you can get over a couple of those kind of hurdles, they might work for you. I mean, I'll be honest, I kind of toyed with it in my current home. We've got a south facing garden. I think that it would probably do pretty. I think we would generate quite a lot of power from the sun against solar panels. But it's just the thought of actually going to do it, and will I be here long enough for it to be worthwhile? I know a lot of home buyers will see solar panels on the roof and go, actually, that's quite a good thing. You know, if you've got an app and you can see how much you're generating and how much money you're saving, it could be worth it.
That's it, Lee, isn't it? Is it viewed generally by buyers in a positive, adding value to a house, or is it negative? You know, how much does it cost for the initial outlay, but also how much does it cost to upkeep? To, I assume it needs repairs, maybe?
It's, I think it's quite low maintenance, and they typically
Okay.
last, I think, up to sort of 20 years. Steve says in this story that it cost him £6,000. That was the upfront outlay. The good times of solar panels really were sort of a decade ago, when you could get into the feed-in tariff system, which is where basically you could sell power back to the grid and get a feed-in tariff price. And people still have these feed-in tariffs, but they were closed. It was closed to people about 6 years ago. That was the real good times of solar panels. And we had various schemes in which you could get money off for getting solar panels installed. Again, kind of that's all sort of disappeared. Could that all make a return potentially? There's lots of energy companies that are offering discounted installations. You can get free quotes, quite possibly from your energy supplier, to see how much it would cost, how much you could potentially get. You know, the pros of them are reduced electricity bills, the sustainability aspect of it. Now, I'm a little bit on the fence in the sustainability cards, because we've had all of this kind of chat, haven't we, with Ed Miliband, and about where solar panels are actually made. You know, the materials that they're made from and the labor that's used to actually put these solar panels together, because a lot of them come from China. And again, I think that is another thing that is on people's minds. Low maintenance, and having it on your roof and being able to create some of your own electricity, and potentially it helping your neighbors as well, is quite good. But
Yeah.
there's big barriers, you know, let's say high initial cost, the weather. Now, Steve says in this story, in December, the solar panels did basically nothing, because it was just the lack of sun, very cloudy, you know. But on the whole, I think it's a bit of that is a bit of a misconception. For most of the year, there is enough sunshine to probably make this worthwhile. The big other big thing is about storage, and whether or not to get a battery installed that can kind of store some of your excess
Right.
power. Batteries are really expensive to have as an extra, and are a little bit more temperamental from what I've heard. There's also space requirements, but some people just think they're an eyesore. You walk around, and some of your neighbors, you know, one in 20 of your neighbors might have solar panels, and sometimes it doesn't look the greatest. You know, these are all things that you have to consider, and all things, as I say, that I've considered as well. Steve likes it because he has an app that shows hour by hour, blow by blow account on how much energy
I can imagine
is.
Steve would like that.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. And he said his panels went up last July. He says that the app tells him that he saved half a ton of carbon dioxide, which is the equivalent of planting 31 trees. So I could kind of, that's quite nice. He said he eventually got his first payment of £100, which is the profit that we're talking about. But he gets paid for each kilowatt hour of spare electricity that he exports to the grid. We currently receive around 15p for each unit, and we've received £300 in total since July. So not only is he shaving money off his own energy bill, he's managing to get, you know, export payments. I said £6,000. He actually says later on in the story that it was over £8,000 in the end. So I'm guessing that was probably an installation charge, and a couple of extra bits and pieces that are kind of associated with it. And he said the scaffolding went up the week before, and it was taken down the week after. There's the other thing that my parting shot on this is that there are quite a lot of I would call them unscrupulous companies that are kind of offering these. I'd be very careful, for
Right.
example, at taking something at face value that drops through your letterbox offering you solar panels. Do your due diligence, make sure you're reading reviews. Personally speaking, I think that it probably makes sense to go with your energy supplier if they offer it and sound them out and find out how much it's going to cost, how long it's going to take, where are your solar panels coming from, and all of those kind of key questions. But if you're happy with the answers, it could make sense. And actually, I talked with someone I've noticed in the last couple of months. They're building a huge solar panel farm not far away from me. And at first, I was like, oh, God. But they're actually sensibly building it alongside a real busy, loud A road where not much else can go there, really, unless you put more warehouses there. But they've already built about a trillion warehouses off of the A road I'm talking about, and they look all right. They actually look all right
Yeah.
when you're going up, and it kind of makes sense for them to be there. And apparently, they're going to generate enough to power 6,000 homes. So,
Decent.
decent. Yeah, it's just it's that again. It's the conversation of whether it's being they're being built on arable farmland. Why aren't they being built on top of things like supermarket car parks and hospital
Yeah, quite.
car parks and all that kind of
Data
stuff?
centers.
They're building a massive data center as well, actually,
So a lot of
in
these
there.
solar panel farms, people think they're going back into the grid to power our homes. They're not. They're actually going to power data centers. There's a controversial one near me, and the power is just going to go direct to the data center. And as the people campaigning against it pointed out, why doesn't the data center have solar panels on its roof?
Is that so that we can say please and thank you to ChatGPT? Is that what we mean for the data?
It is. Well, look, we're consuming, AI is a huge data consumer, and we are on one hand saying we need to use less energy and we need to decarbonize and so on, and talking about things like zonal pricing, and there's going to be a lot more pylons. People need to realize that that's going to be really, really unpopular when all of a sudden loads of pylons start going up. And bear in mind, the government is pretty much shoving through legislation that says if we want to stick a pylon behind your house, it's going there, sunshine. And actually, what's this energy being used for? A data center is the new idea for growth. We need more data centers. We need to be at the forefront of this. We need data centers. But I mean, is that true? Do we want to become a data center economy? I don't know. It's like I asked the same question about airport expansion, for example. Why are we relentlessly expanding our airports at the same time as saying that we need to be, more environmentally friendly? Airports are not environmentally friendly. There's no way you can sell an airport as being environmentally friendly. And why are we continually trying to expand airport capacity around London, which has five major airports, at the same time as we're meant to be leveling up? Why aren't we pushing more, more of that stuff into other parts of the country? I don't think we think about this stuff very well, but I'm very glad to hear that the solar panels are going up next to the road near Lee, because I would like to start a campaign to put solar panels alongside the motorways the entire length of the country. Think about how much land we've got next to motorways, right? Let's just put solar panels either side of them, easily accessible. Got to be able to be connected to the power grid. Surely there's power to motorways, isn't there? I mean, I don't know anything about this. People who do know more about this, email me, podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. Tell me if I'm right. Tell me if I'm an idiot, right? You've got to be able to connect it into the grid. And we've already ruined that land, And also, if it's arable farmland, do you want your food grown right next to a motorway? No.
No.
Nick solar panels there. One last thing on solar panels. If you are thinking about it, look up your local council, so basically your district council, and see if they have a group buying solar panel scheme. A lot of councils are doing this. Don't just, go for it because it's the council, but look it up. You can register for it. They then get, X number of households all together, and then they go to providers and say, we want to do this, and you might get a better price off the back of it. There's no obligation to go ahead with it. So you can find out the price and then make a decision, usually. And if you can't do that, don't sign up for it at all. But if you can, sign up, find out the price, compare the price of getting other companies to do it. Don't just go, okay, well, I'll do it with them, because it might be that someone else can do it cheaper. But this can be a very cost-effective way of getting yourself the solar panels, and you can also potentially get yourself a battery as well. Although I love the bit where Steve said in his column that he decided not to get a battery because it was going to be an extra £6,000, and also he's not a big fan of the company that provides it, aka Mr. Elon Musk's Tesla.
Ah, yes, Elon Musk. I understand Tesla shares have dropped, so he's agreeing to step back a little bit from Doge. Popularity impacting investing there. How interesting. But talking of which, even the most seasoned investors, happy with a fair bit of risk, must have had a few scary moments over the past few months. These have been somewhat testing times. So what is your risk appetite? Are you adventurous, balanced, a cautious investor, perhaps? Well, This Is Money have produced a quiz. You can take a look at it and you can work it out for yourself if you don't know already. Simon, what are you? What is risk appetite? And what is all this about?
Your risk appetite is essentially how much risk you are willing to take in return for rewards. And generally speaking, it's considered that the more risk you take, the higher the potential rewards. But that's not guaranteed. You can take lots of risk and just lose lots of money. A classic example is buying small cap shares, which very small company shares can make huge gains, but they can also make huge losses, and you are much more likely to find a smaller company, early stage company, go bust than a big, well-established company. So if you invest in small cap shares, you're taking lots of risk. You could get lots of reward, but you could also lose lots of money. So you need to take a portfolio approach, do your research properly, etc., and work on the basis that a certain percentage of the companies that you invest in are not just going to disappoint, but are possibly going to go bust. The reason why it's important to think about, what kind of investor you are and your risk appetite is that this impacts how you might behave when markets are down by a lot or markets are up, and how you might be able to handle that. If you're the kind of person, or if you're in a financial situation where you definitely need that money, then you probably shouldn't be investing. If you're in a situation where if you're going to open your account and discover your investments are down 10%, 15%, it's going to really concern you, and you're at the risk of doing something like panic selling, or it's going to cause you mental distress, then you need to be dialing down the risk that you're taking. You also need to think about your financial goals. What are you saving for? Is it something just a really long time in the future, or is it something defined that you need a specific amount of money for? If it's something defined that you need a specific amount of money for, you need to be taking less risk, because if you can't fill that gap, then you've got problems. Is it a house deposit, a dream holiday, a home renovation, or just, retirement? Your children's future. Again, that's a long-term thing. And you might go, okay, do you know what? I can take more risk with my children's investments than I would my own, because I'm not planning on giving them the money for another, 10, 15, 20 years. And actually, if they end up with a bit less in 20 years' time, then that's okay. At least I tried my hardest. Financial independence, retiring early. If you've got a right, I'm definitely done at 45 in your head, then, you're going to need to get good rewards, but do you want to take that much risk? Or if you've got to 43 and you're like, oh my God, I'm nearly there, I can retire at 45. Anybody listening to this, like, the chances of you being able to do that is so slim. I should have chosen, but 55, whatever, choose your number, right? But if you're nearly there, then you don't want to be taking big risks over the last 2 years, because that might blow the whole thing out of the water. So how long are you going to invest for before you need the money? Can you cope financially or emotionally with making losses?
Okay, adventurous, balanced, or cautious? I'll go balanced.
I think you sound quite balanced. I think you'll skew more towards adventurous. I think, but
I
you're
think so.
conscious of the risks that you're taking. And that's the important thing. If you are an adventurous investor, you have to be conscious of the risks that you're taking. If you're a balanced investor, make sure that your investments are actually balanced. And if you're a cautious investor, make sure that your investments are actually cautious, but also question whether you are a cautious investor. There's quite a few people who get defined as cautious investors, but who actually, when you ask them about, well, what do you need this money for? They're like, oh, well, I probably won't ever need it. I'll just give it to the kids as inheritance. That you can afford to take more risk with that.
Finally, what is, there's a bit of a screeching U-turn here, what is the greatest British car of all time? Now, the experts have chosen, but do you agree? Simon, disappointed to note, though, that the classic 2016 Vauxhall Mokka was not in the list. Who pulled this list together? I'm not sure of their credentials, to be honest.
It was a panel of automotive experts. Auto Express got a panel of judges together, and they looked at each car across a number of factors: engineering pedigree, design, commercial success, significance in automotive history, and their long-lasting perception in the hearts of motorists. and I will give you the top 10. Okay. At number 10, the Land Rover Discovery, 1989 to 1998. At number 9, the Ford GT40, 1964 to 1969. For how Ford eventually managed to win Le Mans and defeat Ferrari. Number 8, the Caterham stroke Lotus 7, 1957 to present. Number 7, the Lotus Elise, 1996 to 2021. Little Lotus sports car. Very basic, but a lot of fun. Number 6, the classic James Bond wagon, the Aston Martin DB5. Mm-hmm. Number 5, the McLaren F1, a famous groundbreaking supercar with unusual seating arrangement. Number 4, the Range Rover, 1970 to present. I don't know whether you can class like the early Range Rovers as the same as the modern day Range Rovers. I mean, I suppose the concept
very
is
very different same, aesthetic.
They are very different cars, yeah. But, you know, they're in there. Because the Land Rover Defender, 1948 to 2016. Now that is the old school Defender, not the new school Defender, which is a bit more Range Rover-y. Number 2, though, the Jaguar E-Type, 1961 to 1974. So if the E-Type is number 2, what is number 1? Humble Mini. 1959 to 2000, the original Mini, not the BMW Mini. That was judged to be the best British car of all time.
Killjoy, Simon, but none of these look particularly practical.
Well, a Mini was hugely successful owing to its combination of practicality, frugality and driving fun. Obviously, you can't fit a huge amount of stuff in it, but you could fit an incredible amount of people and stuff in it considering the amount of space it took up. I would argue perhaps a Land Rover Defender is a extremely practical car, beloved by farmers, a workhorse everywhere, and now beloved by rich people who like to flaunt their Defender. The Range Rover, surprisingly practical, but also phenomenally expensive. McLaren F1, not practical. And then, obviously, things like an E-Type. Ford GT40, not practical at all. The E-Type...
What's your favourite?
The E-Type is my number one.
Yeah.
Yeah, but in the rest of the list, there's some other cars here that deserve special mentions. I will give special mentions to the Ford Fiesta, 1976 to 2002.
Knew you'd say that.
Yeah. I'll give special mentions to the Ford Sierra. Who doesn't love a Sierra? The DeLorean, the world's most bonkers car, and made famous, obviously, by Back to the Future and really badly executed. Something a bit more boring, the Nissan Qashqai. It's not my cup of tea, but it's a lot of people's cup of tea. And also the Jaguar XJ220 deserves a mention. But another couple of favourites of mine on there, because my dad had these. A Jaguar XJ6, old school Jag, and a Rover SD1. So there you go.
Right. Right. That's it. If you have any views on what your number one car is, if we've missed something... Anything takes your fancy? Any other comments or questions for the team that you'd like them to look into? Any questions of the week for us? Simon?
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. And chances are you might have some interesting cars, because if you haven't got any interesting cars, you will have tuned out by now.
Yeah, exactly. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.